Sask Ag Today with Doug Faulkner.
Good afternoon and welcome to Sask Ag Today. Coming up on today's program, we will talk to Warren Ward from the Canola Council of Canada. He will tell us about the latest discussions regarding fertilizer use for canola growing and the recommendations that are coming out of that. As well, we will hear from Michael Wilton of Mercantile Consulting Venture in Winnipeg. He'll provide the weekly overview of the wheat market. The House of Commons Standing Committee on the Environment and Sustainable Development is in the middle of a study on fresh water, specifically how to protect it, how to collaborate on all levels of government, and what role does the newly formed Canada Water Agency play in all of it. We will hear what Saskatchewan Association of Rural Municipalities President Ray Orb had to say about it. All of those stories and much more coming up on today's edition of Sask Ag Today. But first, it's time for the Agriculture Outlook with Precision Weather. And that's a presentation of Milligan Bio. Milligan Bio now offers bile meal for your livestock, giving your animals more protein, more energy, and more of what they need. It's also brought to you by Sean Prahitka, your REMAX Blue Chip Ag Division Specialist. Welcome back to Sask Ag Today. A Canola Council of Canada agronomy specialist compares a successful canola crop to a blockbuster Hollywood movie. Warren Ward says both require an A-list star, with canolas being nitrogen. Every movie also needs a strong supporting cast, and it's the same with canola, which requires phosphorus, potassium, sulfur, and micronutrients. University of Saskatchewan researchers recently updated the nutrient uptake and removal guidelines for 14 annual crops grown in Western Canada. To discuss the results for canola, we spoke with Warren Ward.
Some of the values went, in terms of how much it takes to grow a bushel of canola, went down a little bit. Some of them went up a little bit for the various nutrients. So it's definitely worth having a look and looking at those averages when a person is setting some fertilizer targets this year.
He starts out with nitrogen.
With nitrogen, what we found, it went down a little bit in terms of how much nitrogen on average it was taking to grow a bushel of canola. This number is coming from a range, so depending on where you're farming, your farming practices, it might vary within that range a little bit. But the average they found was 2.38 pounds per bushel is how much nitrogen it takes to grow one bushel of canola.
Ward moved on to phosphorus.
Well, canola does use a fair bit of phosphorus, and what we found in this study, actually, is that it uses a little less than we had thought traditionally, but looking at 0.9 pounds of phosphorus to produce one bushel of canola. And so when we're seeing field soil test values that are in that very low range, what we're seeing is fields that are very responsive to phosphorus application. So they've been depleted somewhat over time. Those are the fields that we're going to want to replacement values or even some building values in terms of how much phosphorus fertilizer we're applying to those fields.
He then looked at sulfur.
Yeah, canola is one of the higher sulfur using crops that we grow. It's a tricky one to test for because we know there's a lot of variability with sulfur across the landscape of a field. So even if you have a soil test that is showing high sulfur levels, we still want to make sure that we're adding fertilizer to adequately apply the correct amount of sulfur for that yield target in that field. There is also some recent research out there showing that under drought conditions, that adequate sulfur levels can help improve that crop's stress response.
Ward also mentions potassium.
We've known for a while that canola is a high potassium user. So if we were to look at, based on this study, the numbers they were finding was 2.93 pounds of potassium for one bushel of canola. So that's quite a lot, actually. What we do also know about canola, though, is that it's an efficient scavenger of potassium from the soil. So it's rare that we really see potassium deficiencies in canola, but certainly under some fields or soil conditions, soil types such as the gray wooded or some sandier soils can be deficient in potassium, and those are the ones that we'd want to make sure we're adequately fertilizing or making sure we're fertilizing enough to achieve those yield targets.
He notes producers can go online to learn more about fertilizer recommendations for canola.
We have a lot of information on our Canola Council of Canada website, and we have an excellent resource there called the Canola Encyclopedia, which has really production and management tips for any aspect of canola that you're looking for, including nutrient management. One other link we have on our site is to our Canola Research Hub, where research projects such as this one that looked at the uptake and removal of crops such as canola, we do highlight some of those research results there as well. So it's a great place to go and just brush up on some of the new research that's been happening.
And Ward offered these final comments.
I would just maybe leave it off with this, that, you know, the 4 R's of nutrient management are important, and each of those R's can play a role in impacting each other or helping manage others where you may have some compromises or deficiencies that you want to account for. But further to that, agronomy practices in general are very similar. So we could have the best fertility program with our canola, but if our other agronomy practices are lacking, such as even something like timely weed control, we're not going to see the benefit from those practices. So we do want to make sure that we're focusing on the whole approach of growing canola and seeing the maximum benefit from that.
Warren Ward is an agronomy specialist with the Canola Council of Canada, based in the Yorkton area. It's time now for the Ag Review portion of our program, and that's a presentation of New Era Ag Technologies in Swan River.
GX94, Ag Review.
The Agricultural Producers Association of Saskatchewan, or APAS, and the Saskatchewan Cattlemen's Association want Ottawa to reinstate the $350,000 interest-free portion of its advance payments program, known as the cash advance. It's been 3 years since the interest-free portion was at $100,000. APAS President Ian Boxall says since that time, grain prices have declined, interest rates jumped, and input costs remain high. APAS estimates the lower interest-free portion could cost producers an estimated $30,000 in interest costs. The topic will be on the agenda next week when the Canadian Federation of Agriculture holds its annual convention in Ottawa. Federal Agriculture Minister Lawrence McAuley will also be in attendance. Speculators added to their already record large net short position in early February, according to the latest Commitments of Traders report from the United States Commodity Futures Trading Commission. As of February 13th, the net managed money short position in canola futures came in at 147,603, which was up by roughly 9,000 contracts from the former record hit just the previous week. Open interest in the canola market came in at 308,702 contracts, which was up by 3,894 on the week. At the Chicago Board of Trade, the net short position in soybeans increased by about 3,000 contracts on the week, at about 124,400 contracts. Green lentils continue to show solid premiums over their red counterparts, with prices for both old and new crop green lentils well above where they were at this time a year ago. Spot bids for large green lentils delivered to the elevator were trading anywhere from 60 to 76 cents per pound in mid-February 2024, according to Prairie Ag Hotwire data. That compares with bids topping out at 50 cents per pound at the same time a year ago. Meanwhile, the market on red lentils is relatively steady with year-ago levels. Current spot bids of 28 to 36 cents per pound have softened over the past month, compared with pricing in the 30 to 32 cents per pound range in February of 2023. A U.S. environmental group is pointing a finger at Canadian oat growers, saying they're the cause of ag chemical residues found in Cheerios and Quaker oats. Late last week, the Environmental Working Group released a study on oats and chloramaquat, a plant growth regulator marketed as manipulator. Farmers apply chloramaquat to oats and cereal crops to decrease the height of plants and reduce the risk of lodging. The study, published February 15th in the Journal of Exposure Science and Environmental Epidemiology, looked at the presence of chloramphenicol in urine and foods. The scientists collected 96 urine samples from 2017 to 2023, and chloramphenicol was detected in 77 samples, or 80% of cases. The urine came from adults in Florida, South Carolina, and Missouri. More than 2,000 soil samples across Canada's potato-producing provinces came back free of potato wart for a clean bill of health. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency, in its 2023 National Potato Wart Survey, tested for the soil-borne fungus in British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island. This marks the second year the survey turned up no cases of potato wart, though the 2022 survey did not include PEI, which struggled with the fungus in 2021 and 2022. In late 2021, two processing potato fields on the island were confirmed infected with potato wart. On U.S. trade concerns, the federal government shut down fresh potato exports from the province. Most trade resumed in April of 2022. The 2021 cases were followed by confirmations in February, July, and December of 2022, bringing in export restrictions and mitigation orders. And SaskAg Today is always available on podcast. Listen to past shows whenever you want. Find them easily by going to gx94radio.com. Also, you can hear the podcast on your Amazon Echo. Just enable the GX94 skill and choose SaskAg Today. And yes, it is free. And that's the Ag Review portion of our program. Please stay tuned. SaskAg Today will return right after this. Welcome back to SaskAg Today. I'm Doug Falconer. It's mainly cloudy and minus 4 degrees in the Yorkton-Melville region. I'll have your complete weather details coming up at 1 o'clock. The House of Commons Standing Committee on the Environment and Sustainable Development is in the middle of a study on fresh water, specifically how to protect it, how to collaborate on all levels of government, and what role does the newly formed Canada Water Agency play in all this. Back on January 31st, the first committee meeting of the year, there was a handful of people who provided their thoughts on the topic of fresh water, including the president of the Saskatchewan Association of Rural Municipalities, Ray Orb.
I was born and raised and live in the small farming community of Cupar, which is northeast of Regina, with a population of about 625 people. I'd like to thank the Standing Committee on Environment and Sustainable Development for the opportunity to share our association's thoughts as it studies fresh water in Canada and the role of the federal government. SARM has been the voice of rural Saskatchewan and has served its membership of Saskatchewan's rural and municipal governments for over 100 years. Today, I express our viewpoints of those we represent, delving into rural perspectives on fresh water in Canada and explaining how the role of the federal government might influence our livelihoods in rural Saskatchewan. Agriculture is the backbone of Saskatchewan's rural economy, and it relies heavily on a consistent and reliable supply of fresh water, especially for groundwater and water for irrigation. Crops and livestock require sufficient water to thrive, ensuring food security for not only our country, but also for our customers abroad. We need fresh water to sustain the livelihoods of countless families, not just in Saskatchewan, but across Canada. And by working collectively, the federal government will better understand the dynamics and potential harmful impacts on watershed and groundwater recharge, along with ensuring agriculture access and resiliency to sustainable high-quality water. It would also be essential for the agency to leverage other federal government entities such as the Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, the Pest Management Regulatory Agency, Environment and Climate Change Canada, to consider all the potential impacts on a larger scale. SARM voiced concerns some time ago about creating a Canada Water Agency. We are concerned that we will have duplication since we already have a Saskatchewan Water Security Agency and a strong entity in the Saskatchewan Ministry of Environment. In essence, water and water quality is a multi-jurisdictional issue and must be dealt with in that manner. Although we are not in favor of this agency, we do anticipate the agency will need transparency with the provinces. To achieve strong working relationships with the provinces, we recommend sharing data and knowledge, engaging with agencies, councils, and organizations in each province on proposed changes to fresh water to consider impacts to all sectors of each province. Leverage the knowledge of local and regional networks involved in water management in each province and further strengthen their sources and ensure that there is a sense of respect for jurisdiction and constitutional authority in each province. Continuing to dialogue with SARM on issues that affect farmers, ranchers, and rural municipalities. Saskatchewan is an active participant in water management. An example of our actions can be sought out in the Diefenbaker Irrigation Expansion Project. Saskatchewan provides funding through associations and programs, such as the Saskatchewan Irrigation Projects Association and the Farm and Ranch Water Infrastructure Program, to ensure farmers and producers can work together to provide freshwater access across Saskatchewan. A primary focus of the agency should be on funding water management projects across Canada to ensure provinces can work efficiently and effectively to preserve freshwater resources. With additional funding stability and support beyond the province of Saskatchewan borrowing money from the Canadian Infrastructure Bank, the federal government could help provinces dramatically in making a bigger impact on freshwater resources. The Saskatchewan Water Security Agency is working toward developing the Saskatchewan Agriculture Water Stewardship Policy, which aims to preserve, restore, and protect the wetlands in Saskatchewan. And on a larger scale, the agency will need to develop a sustainable and resilient freshwater management strategy that works with all provinces. This strategy will be essential to help provinces adapt to these federal changes and mitigate potential risks. It is crucial that the federal government, provinces, and territories work together to ensure to build a sustainable future for generations to come. So in closing, on behalf of our member rural municipalities and rural Saskatchewan, we thank the Standing Committee for the opportunity to lend our voice to this important conversation, and we look forward to continued dialogue to work together to further the best interests of all Canadians. Thank you.
That's the Saskatchewan Association of Rural Municipalities President, Ray Orb.
Livestock market conditions.
U.S. live cattle futures for April are trading at 187.90 this afternoon. That's up 57. June live cattle trading at 183.45, up 50. March feeder cattle trading at 251.37, that's unchanged from yesterday's close. April feeder cattle trading at 256.17, up 82. April lean hogs trading at 85.80, that's up 12. May lean hogs trading at 89.25, up 25. And that's the livestock market conditions. Michael Wilton of Mercantile Consulting Venture has provided his weekly overview of the wheat market. It was issued through the Saskatchewan Wheat Development Commission.
U.S. wheat futures were lower last week with the rising U.S. dollar, falling global cash wheat prices, and forecasts for strong U.S. wheat production in the upcoming 24-25 season. As far as some of the most important news that happened in the wheat markets last week, we'll start with the International Grains Council, which released their February grain market report. Global production was revised slightly lower, 300,000 tons lower, as a 1 million ton decrease in Russia's production was offset by more production in the EU and other countries. Global wheat trade was raised by about 2 million tons by more imports in the EU and more exports from Australia and Ukraine. Total wheat supply was reduced by almost 2 million tons, given a decrease in production and a 1.6 million ton decrease in beginning stocks. Reductions in the food, feed, and industrial use amounted to about 1.3 million tons, which caused use to decline to 8.04 million tons, which would still be a record. A slightly smaller reduction in use than supply caused the International Grains Council to decrease ending stocks by 600,000 tons from last month to 265 million tons, down 15 million tons from last year and the lowest level in 5 years. All right, let's move on over to Canada. We had an AFC update. AFC raised Canadian use and exports for the 23-24 season for a 400,000-ton decrease in ending stocks to 3.1 million tons. Exports were raised by 250,000 tons, which reflects a 2% decrease from last year. We think that this was a necessary revision, and exports could probably actually surpass that. We'll see. For the 24-25 season, so the upcoming season, an increase in harvested area caused the AFC to increase production by 629,000 tons to 28.5 million tons, up 2% from the previous year. Food and feed use were raised by 229,000 tons for an unchanged ending stock number of 3.5 million tons, up 13% from the previous season. As far as the monthly exports go, we had our December wheat exports, which were pegged at 1.8 million tons. The largest consumer in December was Indonesia, who imported 253,000 tons of the monthly volume. August to December exports to Indonesia are now about 50% more than last year's volume. Exports to China are still strong at 228,000 tons, although this volume was just about half of November's large export program. China's imports of Canadian wheat are 1.2 million tons year to date, which is 33% behind last year's pace. Exports to the U.S. remain strong. At a year-to-date total of 760,000 tons, the U.S. is Canada's third largest customer this year and is currently importing at a pace that is just under 50% ahead of last year. As far as the weekly export data go, Canadian exports shipped 571,000 tons of wheat in week 28, which is a very good volume. Total exports today are running 8% ahead of last year, despite the AFC's 20.25 million ton number, which reflects a 2% decrease. Canadian exports will need to continue to slow, but we are optimistic that they will surpass the AFC's current number. For durum, Canadian durum exports in December were 267,000 tons, resulting in an August to December season total of 1.3 million tons. Morocco was the largest importer of Canadian durum in December at 50,000 tons. Exports were lower to most of the Canadian durum markets, with large decreases in Italy, which has only taken 75% of last year's volume, and Tunisia. These countries have bought significant volumes of Turkish durum. Breaking down Canadian exports by destination, it looks like it will be difficult for Canada to ship much more than the 3.0 million tons of durum, compared to the AFC's guess of 3.2 million tons. Turkish durum has satisfied approximately 1.5 million tons of demand that would have otherwise been available to Canada, so we'll watch for further developments here. As far as the weekly durum export data goes, week 28 exports were strong at 135,000 tons for a season total of 1.7 million tons. We are now 54% through the marketing year and have shipped 60% of the total expected export volume. And we'll head on over to the U.S., where some of the big news was the USDA Ag Outlook Forum. The USDA Ag Outlook Forum put U.S. all wheat acres for the upcoming season at 47 million acres. This is down 5% from last year, but still above the five-year average. A return to average abandonment is expected to cause harvested area to surpass last year by 1.1 million acres. All wheat yield is expected to be 49.5 bushels per acre, which is a 2% improvement from last year, causing total production to rise 5% year over year to 1.9 billion bushels. Higher supply and only slightly larger use caused the USDA to increase the expected carryout for the 24-25 season by 111 million bushels from the current year. That would mean they would be carrying out about 769 million bushels, which would be the largest volume in 4 years. And we'll head on over to Australia, where wheat prices were sharply lower last week as the slow start to their export program has not improved. With planting approaching, West Australia is dry, while the southeast has strong moisture conditions. In Argentina, Argentina is returning from their holidays. Wheat there continues to be offered around $230 per ton. But it seems like demand has been slow at a time when exporters are sitting on unused licenses. In the European Union, Matif wheat futures continued to slide last week, with the May contract falling below 200 euros per ton. The France Agrimer increased French ending stocks by another 100,000 tons to a 19-year high of 3.5 million tons of ending stocks. French wheat exports continue to struggle against Black Sea competition. The first crop report of the season conducted by France Agrimer showed the French winter wheat crop is the poorest condition in 4 years, but so far the market is not paying attention as they have a large old crop carry. Official data shows EU wheat exports 8% behind last year, although some private estimates say that they're doing a little bit better than that. And over in the Black Sea, following the decrease in the floor price that we talked about last week, the Russian government increased the all-grain export quota by 4 million tons to 28 million tons. Russia seems to be making a concerted effort to ship out the old crop, as the new crop harvest is just over 3 months away. The decrease in the floor price and the larger export quota did not allow Russia to win the most recent GASC, or Egyptian, tender, however, which went to Ukraine and Romania. Romania's wheat was $19 per ton more expensive on a FOB basis than Ukraine's, but this was made up for the wide freight spread. The last purchase by GASC is back to pre-war prices, but the devaluation of the Egyptian pound means that wheat is still extremely expensive in the local currency. Winter kill of Ukraine's winter wheat crop is estimated to be just 1 to 2%. The mild winter there has allowed for less heavy frosts and ice cresting, which often causes winter kill to be as high as 7% of the total winter wheat seeded area. As far as some of the cash wheat business goes, Jordan bought 60,000 tons of optional origin hard wheat at $253, and Egypt bought 180,000 tons of milling wheat from Ukraine and Romania at $255. And we note that this is $30 per ton less than their most recent purchase. We mentioned before that $255 per ton US is roughly what trade was happening before the Russia started invading Ukraine. But on local currency terms, it remains quite expensive given the decrease in value of the Egyptian pound. And so what does this all mean for the outlook? The opportunity for an old crop wheat rally is dwindling. Every major wheat exporter still has wheat to ship, and exporters will be competing for shipping windows in the next 3 months before the new crop harvest starts. There are also questions if there's demand for all of the available wheat, as currency devaluations in many importing nations means that wheat continues to be expensive, even though wheat prices in US dollars are approaching pre-war levels. We would be fully sold of our Durham crop and would be looking for opportunities to in spring wheat for additional sales.
That's Michael Wilton of Mercantile Consulting Venture in Winnipeg. Please stay tuned. Your commodities update is coming up next.
Commodities update.
Canola futures are trading down across the board this hour. March canola trading at $575.50, down $9.30. May canola trading at $585.50, down $7.90. March Minneapolis wheat trading at $6.59¾, down 5¾¢. March Kansas City wheat trading at $5.76 per bushel, down 9¾¢. March Chicago wheat trading at $5.80½, down 2¼¢. March corn trading at $4.11½, down 7¼¢. March soybeans trading at $11.64½, down 14½¢. March oats trading at $3.72 per bushel, that's down 8¢. And that's the commodities update. Please stay tuned. SaskAg Today will return right after this. Welcome back to SaskAg Today. I'm Doug Faulkner. The Saskatchewan Wheat Development Commission is asking producers to consider adding winter wheat to their crop rotation. Dr. Brian Barris is the senior research scientist at Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada's Lethbridge Research Centre, and he talks about the benefits of using a seed treatment on winter wheat.
This was a really cool study that we built on some anecdotal information and also some bench lab studies out of Europe. And even the life sciences companies weren't 100% sure how this would work in especially the northern latitudes with winter wheat and knowing the level of abiotic stress that winter wheat can be exposed to. And that was the whole point here. It was, let's separate out all the active ingredients that are possible in a seed treatment from the, you know, neonic insecticides to the various different fungicides. And let's see what makes a difference and why and try and understand that. And so myself, Kelly Turkington, and Randy Kuchar got together and brainstormed a couple of experiments to come out of that. And really, to make a long story short, we dramatically changed the plant activity in such a way that it became way more resistant to abiotic stress. So leave alone your concern about biotic stress when it comes to winter wheat, a fair concern given how long it sits there in the soil in a vegetative state. It can be exposed to all kinds of biotic threats. But the reality that we learned is that it's really more about the level of abiotic stress that it experiences. If you do use a seed treatment that has both your really good tebuconazole, prothioconazole type seed fungicides along with your neonic insecticide, it's all about how they alter the metabolic pathways in that plant to make it way more resistant to abiotic stress. And the other thing it does is partly by explanation is that it creates significantly more plants in the field. So you protect the ones that might otherwise die off. And what that gives you isn't, let's say it's not always significantly higher yield, although it usually is, but what it is in every single case is significantly higher yield stability. So that's the other key to this that we really stress in my own work is like, okay, we're working on systems and this whole genotype by environment, by management framework in order to keep improving yield productivity. But equally important, we need to have stabilized yields so that from year to year, farm to farm, we have yields that are going to be consistent.
He tells us which products he looked at during that study.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a secret. We were actually working with Bayer Crop Sciences because at the time they had this sustainability in action program with Ducks Unlimited. So they were sort of a behind the scenes funding partner. And so in this particular case, it was all the actives that you would find in, say, Araxyl WW or something like that. So you've got things like tebuconazole, prothioconazole, you know, imidacloprid on the stress shield side. So today, if you're wondering as a producer what that looks like, it would be like a Raxel WW or a Raxel Pro. But Raxel Pro is just the two fungicides. You would want to go Raxel Pro with Stress Shield, or another equivalent would be, I think, Cruiser Max and so on that side. But the key is always that you've got both those really good fungicides and coupled with that neonic component as well.
Dr. Barris then goes into the best seeding depth and seeding rate for winter wheat.
Winter wheat is a little bit different from spring wheat in that it's got what we call a shorter coleoptile. So it would sort of use and perhaps get weakened if we went too deep. So we don't really like to see it deeper than, say, you know, you're targeting around 3/4 of an inch or so. Honestly, not a whole lot different than what you're doing with your canola, to be honest. So that's an easy one. Rates are sometimes a debate. I'll give a funny story about that, but typically, you know, if you take some of the studies we've done on spring wheat, where we see a positive and linear trend with seeding rates that go and extend into 450 seeds per square meter or 45 seeds per square foot with spring wheat, some cultivars, and you say, okay, if yield potential keeps increasing, is an adjustment to seed density necessary to exploit that? And I believe yes, for most of those new genetics. And so, you know, that sweet spot for winter wheat would be that 450. And for me on the spring wheat side would be 400. So you're kind of 40 per square foot for spring wheat, 45 per square foot with winter wheat, right? Because ultimately, we don't have any control over plants. So when I hear about target plant this and that, or somebody's planting it, so many plants, it makes no sense to me, because all we have control over are the number of seeds going in the ground. So once you know you've got, and you've confirmed you've got a viable seed lot with, you know, 90% plus germination, the vigor's good, you've got it treated, now it's going in the ground, you're going to be good at 45 seeds per square foot. And that's going to give you at least that minimum threshold of 20 plants per square foot. It's probably going to be closer to 25 to 30, which is even better. But people talk a lot about, well, cheat my seeding rate back because winter wheat's got high plasticity or high tillering capacity. And that's true, it does. But that should just be left as sort of an emergency option of, if things really went bad, at least it's got the tillering capacity to come back and fill in, kind of like when you have a weak stand of canola. Like canola and winter wheat that way with plasticity, is they're quite similar. That doesn't mean we should be relying and leaning on them, because it doesn't necessarily give you the yield or the productivity. And that, well, now with that said, there's lower seeding rates that could give you the same yield in some years and environments. But again, going back to the yield stability, if you want to capture yield stability, you need the higher seed rates. And an example of that, we showed our seed treatment work, and we could show that if we had a really not so great seed lot, if we did actually put a seed treatment on it and even cut back our seeding rates, we were getting sometimes yields that were the same as your optimum seeding rate. The problem though is if you then overlaid a proxy for yield stability, that's when it falls apart. 1 year, it might do just as fine, or 2 years, but are you actually going to farm and manage your farm on the 2 out of 10 years, like I say, or are you going to try and do it for the environments that happen, say, 7, 8 out of 10?
So he believes it's better to go with a higher seeding rate.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know the seed treatments aren't getting any cheaper. And I know there's some years where you won't actually see 250 versus 450 seeds per square meter. Might not cover that cost. How much value are you going to put on yield stability? And the fact there's going to be that year where you needed all 45 seeds per square foot, and it really paid off because you had, you know, where we see this, or even nitrogen management, obviously, is when you have those higher productivity environments, right? So if you do get in that situation and you've cheated it, well, now you've really shot yourself in the foot, because you've never got close to what you could have in terms of returns that otherwise were easily done with those other optimal management practices.
Dr. Brian Barris is the senior research scientist at Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada's Lethbridge Research Centre. His comments come from the Wheat Profit podcast, produced by the Saskatchewan Wheat Development Commission. And that'll do it for SaskAg Today for today. Be sure to tune in again tomorrow at 12:15 for another edition of the program.